Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today's program, Professor Alan Wu. He is director of the Clinical Chemistry and Toxicology Laboratories at San Francisco General Hospital and medical director of the Pharmacogenomics Laboratory at the University of California, San Francisco. Professor Wu.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you all for joining me tonight. I know it might have been a little difficult negotiating the Super Bowl traffic, but you're here, and that's the only thing that's important. So my topic today is taking ownership of your clinical laboratory test results. I'm a laboratory director at SFGH, and it's my job, my day job, to provide data for people who have medical issues. And I've been doing this for a number of years, and over the years I've sort of put together a collection of cases and stories that that I think you might be interested in. But what I'd like to start off first is justifying why it is important that you take control of your clinical lab test results, because if you don't, then some of the bad things that I describe in my stories can very much happen. So I want to sort of start off with my journey here a little bit. Went to school at Purdue in Indiana and University of Illinois, so originally from the Midwest, and then did a little foray at UConn and Hartford Hospital, where I trained and also went back as a director. Did some time in Texas, and then I'm just happy to be here now in San Francisco. So been east, I've been west, I've been south, and I've been in the Midwest, and I can say that my last stop will be right here. So why do you need to take control of your medical information? So I want to start off with some facts and figures. 70% of all medical decisions are based on the results of clinical laboratory tests. Now, we're talking about blood tests. So they could be cholesterol, it could be DNA, it could be proteins. We do a lot of different things in the clinical laboratory. Now, when you combine the other types of lab tests that people get for different diseases, like radiology or biopsies, then we're really talking about almost every medical decision is based on laboratory tests. And despite that, despite the importance of medical tests, most of the people in the general public don't understand what it takes to get a good result that's sort of taken for granted. You take a sample, send it to the lab, and you get a result. And then based on that, major medical decisions are being made. But how good is that information? How reliable can we trust the information that's being provided? Is it perfect? I think you already know the answer to that. Nothing's perfect. And as a result, not just laboratory data, but other types of medical mistakes account for over 100,000 deaths every year in the United States and would be ranked third behind heart disease and cancer alone. Now, you're not going to see this figure published by the American Medical Association. In fact, I think a lot of the people who who are doctors may take offense to some of the things I'm going to say. But I think it's important that you understand that the system has some flaws, and we will all be better off if we understand what those flaws are. So here is a headline news, Washington Post. This is already dated 1999, and it's still true today, even 17 years later. 98,000 deaths linked per year to medical mistakes. And I just need to show you pictures, and you'll get an idea that this is actually reality. So this is Maurice Gibb. We know about Michael. More recently, Joan Rivers. And I just hope that your picture isn't going to be next on this list. So how did this happen? Well, a lot of times it's inappropriate selection or dosing of drugs that produce unexpected side effects. This is really where the world of personalized medicine is coming into vogue, and I'll have some cases describing exactly what that is and why we can improve on medical care with the advent of these new testing modalities that we have. As I said, there can be medical mistakes made by doctors, by laboratorians like myself, we're all human, or even by devices, they sometimes cause harm. And it's just really all over the map here, and I don't want to discount the possibility that there can be also failures of patients not seeking second opinions, not doing their due diligence about finding out what's wrong with them and what they can do to improve their health. All right, so everybody shares in this 100,000 deaths per year. Now, this is a slide that shows the growth in national health expenditures as a percentage of the gross domestic product in the United States. And you can see from 1965, when it was just a modest 5% of our GDP, it is almost 20% today. So every dollar that you spend, 20 cents, is for healthcare. And that is a trend that I believe cannot continue. And this is why we are talking about healthcare reform, and we're talking about the Affordable Health Care Act. Whether or not that will survive with the next administration remains to be seen. But I think it's fair to say that the rate that we're spending on healthcare cannot continue. It certainly cannot continue to grow. And unfortunately, it actually needs to grow because the population is getting older. And we need more healthcare, not less. And where's the money going to come from? So here's a slide that compares us with some of the other Western countries. And we're in the red curve, as you can see, compared to Switzerland, Canada, Sweden. These are all Western countries with excellent healthcare. And can we really say today that our healthcare in the United States is necessarily better than the rest of the world, even though we're spending twice as much as anybody else? I mean, I think if we can demonstrate that we're getting value for the dollar, we might accept that. But point of fact is, at least in terms of one indicator, and this is the infant mortality rate for all of these very same countries that are listed on the right-hand side of the slide, we can see that we're last. So not only are we not as good, we're actually worse in many of the important indicators that we value. So we cannot continue at this rate. And part of the reason that I tell you this is that I'm hoping that when healthcare costs start coming, cuts rather, start coming, that they'll leave our door alone, that we will survive because of the vital importance that the laboratory plays, that perhaps there are other medical specialties that will see the axe and may not be as vital or perhaps doesn't cover as big of the population as we do. So that's part of somewhat selfish and self-serving motivation, is to convince you that what we do is vitally important. Okay? So I want to sort of compare this with what we're doing. So in the dietary world, we have changed our patterns in the last 20 years. We buy organic produce. We look at nutritional labels. We want to avoid trans fat. We want to avoid GMO products. So we are healthier today because we're taking control of our diet, and we're trying to understand the bad things that we can get when we don't eat good foods. But the key question for this lecture is this. If we're so interested in what we put into our bodies, how come we're not interested in what is being done to our body? We sort of say, well, doc, you think I need to have this or I need to have that done or give this procedure or this drug? And most of the time we say, okay. We don't challenge. We don't do our own investigations. We don't look it up. We don't ask for a second opinion. Perhaps a generation ago, that would have been unheard of. But today, that's not an excuse. We can go to the internet. We can learn about all the things that are being done to us. We can make rational decisions about our future, our near-term future, that can have a direct bearing on your mortality. So, what can you do? Review your own medical information The good news is that they're available now like they never have been before. So you can go online. You can look up your laboratory data with your password and all that. You can initiate a discussion with your doctor about what it is that they are recommending for you. Okay, so you may think, well, all right, doctors are having less and less time to talk to patients, and they just want to push pills and get you out of there. And to some extent, that may be true. But I also venture to think that if you ask intelligent questions, that you do your homework, and that you actually ask questions that make them think that they will find the time, that this is not just, oh, you have diabetes and you need to cut out sweets. Okay, well, okay, we know that already. But if you said, well, you know, this laboratory test suggests that I might have a diabetic kidney complications, and what can I do to alleviate my risks for renal disease? Okay, well, then that is a pointed question, and that's going to make your care, I think, better. So this is part of my theme today. Understand the basis behind the medical decisions that are being made. And one way to do that is to understand how the clinical laboratory works. And that way, you have sort of a behind-the-scenes look at what's being done and where perhaps the weaknesses in our system are, and have really a conversation. So what I don't want you to think, and I don't want you to walk away and say, well, he's asking me to play doctor, and he's asking me to make the medical decisions independent of my physician. No. No, I'm not saying that at all. Your physician is still going to make the best decision that person has for you. I'm just saying that let's just make sure that you understand what they're doing and that you have a role in the decision-making process, that you participate in some of the decisions, and you have choices. And you'll find that they will listen when it comes to that, because they are afraid that you won't be compliant if you go against their recommendations. Okay? So this gets to how do you find out more information and where are the stories? So I have written a series of books. There's actually four in all. And I want to talk about this one first, which is not listed in the back of the room. It's called The Hidden Assassin, When Clinical Lab Tests Go Awry. It's a collection of short stories that involve real cases that are either in the public eye or perhaps I have seen at the general or at the other stops that I've been in. They are de-identified because of privacy laws. But the lessons that are learned here are ones that I hope that if you read my stories, you can take away and benefit from personally. Lab tests are only as good as the people who interpret results. So I want to start off with one that is not one of my cases. It's a woman from Seattle. Her name is Jennifer. This is the real case. In my story, I don't use her name. And I want to show you a video of what happened to poor Jennifer.
Welcome, Jennifer Ruffer. Jennifer, we're glad to have you.
She is spreading the message about how she was diagnosed with cancer on 44 blood tests made by Abbott Labs. She endured chemotherapy, a hysterectomy, and lung surgery, only to learn the blood test was wrong. But while Ruffer's courtroom...
Only to learn that the blood test was wrong, okay? This is the theme of my books, that a single laboratory test led a physician to think that she had some type of ovarian cancer, didn't get a second opinion, didn't do the additional tests that are necessary, recommended that she have her uterus removed. She's 22 years old at the time. This is a disaster that should never have happened. I wanted to have kids. I desperately wanted to have a family. Oops. And it's not just Jennifer. There were actually many women who had these terrible procedures. Positive HCG, so this is a test that we run that determines if you're pregnant, but at the same time is a marker for cancer. Some of these women had hysterectomies like Jennifer. They underwent chemotherapy. They had a DNC. They had a laparoscopy. And there was absolutely nothing wrong with them. Let me tell you another case, another series of cases that are even more horrific. A diabetic woman develops pelvic inflammatory disease and has surgery to remove adhesions around her small bowel. While in the intensive care unit, her blood glucose levels are regulated to within tight limits by insulin. So testing is done at the bedside. If the results are a little bit high, a bolus of insulin is given to bring it back down. Studies have shown that when you do that, people do better. Okay? Glucose is tested at bedside, but there was an interferent in her blood that produced an erroneous device, an erroneous result by the device. Okay, so what are adhesions? These are sometimes happen. The left side is normal. The right side are these fibrous materials that attach to the small bowel and sometimes the large bowel and sort of restrict movement. It can be very painful. And so this was the procedure that was done. It was an elective procedure, and everything should have been fine, just like Joan Rivers had an elective procedure, and she never left the hospital, at least not alive. And then shortly after this case, we get this FDA black box warning. Dear healthcare practitioner, we want to alert you to the possibility of falsely elevated blood glucose when using the GDHPQQ glucose test strips on patients receiving certain therapeutic products. These can elevate glucose results, which may either mask hypoglycemia, low glucose levels, or more tragically, can prompt excessive administration in a falsely positive result, a hyperglycemic situation leading to serious injury and death. There were hundreds of patients who died in the ICU before this was uncovered. How did it happen in this particular case? Well, the woman was given this compound known as icohextrin. Icohextrin is a polymer that keeps fluids inside their peritoneum to be lubricated and prevent formation of new adhesions. Now, remember, she had these adhesions. They kind of cut the adhesions out, and then they gave her this icohextrin to sort of keep it oiled. Well, nobody knew then that icohextrin breaks down into these sugars. They're not glucoses, but they are picked up by the PQQ method, and this woman had a false positive result. And as a result, was given insulin inappropriately, went into a diabetic coma, and became one of my stories. You don't want to be a subject in one of my stories. So I mentioned at the outset, we need to avoid medical errors. So pharmacogenomics is a science that determines if the drug you're taking is optimal or if the dose that is being prescribed for you is correct. Okay, so here is a handful of pills, all right? And every pill has a certain purpose, but more importantly, not every pill is for everybody. So, for example, this one pill down here, that could be for the Donald, whereas this other pill up here above, well, perhaps that for Hillary, all right? The point is that we can determine if the pill that you're taking is right for you or not, because if it's not right, bad things can happen. This is the emerging field of pharmacogenomics. This is something that we're going to be seeing much more of. President Obama has created a precision medicine task force. Governor Brown in the state of California has a similar task force. We are members of that task force. So here is one of my stories. It's called The Dangers of Warfarin. Now, I hope nobody here has any bad experience with warfarin. This is about a real estate agent who develops atrial fibrillation. Her doctor says, "Don't worry, I will take good care of you." She's given 5 milligrams. Unfortunately, a few weeks later, she develops a debilitating stroke. the pharmacogenomic lab post hoc does an analysis of her blood and find out that she is a slow metabolizer, that 1 milligram was her optimum dose, not 5 milligrams. She developed a stroke because she was overdosed with warfarin. So the title of this particular story is called A Fib About a Fib. Doctor did not take care of her. Warfarin comes in different dosages. You can't give the same dosage and hope that it's going to work for everybody in the same way. Okay, and this is an alternate reality slide that I threw in because of Bill. Bill was a UC Berkeley graduate student, I guess, during the 60s, if that's correct, and was very much against the war at the time. Well, a lot of people don't know that Hubert Humphrey was also very much against the war, and he was vice president under LBJ. Okay, so he was put into a corner and said, shut up, we're going to escalate the war. You know, your pacifism is not helping us. And when LBJ declined to run for the 1968 presidential election, Humphrey got the nomination, all right? And he maintained this this connection with the LBJ's war administration until the very end of his campaign when it looked like he was going to lose anyway. And so it wasn't until September or late September that he said, you know, forget about LBJ. I'm going to say that if you elect me president, I'm going to pull the troops out of Vietnam. And that changed the tide. He all of a sudden went from a triple digit or 30-point disadvantage to Nixon. Every week he closed the gap to the point that at the time of the election itself, he had only lost by a few hundred thousand votes. And historians now think that had he changed his policy to a pacifism before he did in history, Humphrey could have been the president. There would be no Watergate. Everything would change, right? All right, so why do I bring this up? We now know, 10 years later after he died, that he had a mutation in this in his gene called P53. And that P53 today would have told us that he had bladder cancer, which he ended up dying from in 1974. We didn't know it then. There were permission granted by Muriel Humphrey. They had his bladder biopsy at the National Cancer Institute, and they did his tests, and they found out, yeah, we knew back then if we had the technology. So my what-if story is that he had cancer while he was running for the presidency. And perhaps he finds out at the point of the election, I'm sorry, at the point of the Democratic nomination, and those of you who are old enough know the 1968 Democratic convention in Chicago was also a nightmare. But nevertheless, he changes his tune early in August instead of September, gets a groundswell for pacifism, becomes president, everything changes. All because of the existence of a laboratory test that could have changed the world. Okay, so some of my stories, I kind of play into that. I say, well, we have technologies today that had they been available at a critical point in time in history, could have changed the course of history. All right? So I'm not going to tell you any more of those. Instead, I want to move on to my other book of my collection. It's called Toxicology, Because What You Don't Know Can Kill You. And these are stories about the innocent and the guilty. So here is one of them. This is about a woman by the name of Patricia Stallings. She lived in a lake in a small town outside of St. Louis, just delivered a baby, newly wed, brand new house, nice job. Everything was perfect for the family. Then one day, the little boy started throwing up. And so the family took the baby to the hospital to do a medical workup. They couldn't figure out why he was sick, had a high fever temperature, what we call a metabolic acidosis, was producing too much acid. And then they did some investigations. They sent some investigators to the house, and they said, there's something wrong here. This picture is not working out, that perhaps the child was poisoned. And so what the investigators found was that they retrieved the baby bottle that was given to the child just before he got really sick. They tested it. They tested the blood and urine of the baby, and they found antifreeze. Antifreeze is very toxic and can produce the symptoms that that she suffered from. So a trial was heard. She was charged with endangerment of her own child. We have a medical condition that's called Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And then while she was being held, her son actually died in the hospital, and she ended up being charged with murder. And she was serving a prison sentence. She was pregnant at the time with her second child. The second child was delivered, brought back to the family. She was in jail. And it turned out that the second child, about the same time that the first child got sick, about 6 weeks later, the second child got sick by the same symptoms. But this time the mother wasn't around. She couldn't have poisoned it. There was no ethylene glycol around. So what happened here? Well, once it turns out, there was a medical mistake made. Instead of ethylene glycol, which is the poison in antifreeze, the other lab, a different lab, found propionic acid. Now, propionic acid is something that's found in some babies who have what we call an inborn error metabolism. It's not normal, but if you have a specific genetic disease, you can produce this acid, and it looked like to this laboratory to be ethylene glycol. So a new case was heard. She was exonerated, and she was released from prison. You had a question? I will repeat the question. So the question is, what does this case say about the clinical laboratory, and how could they have made that kind of mistake? Well, first of all, this was 25 years ago, and we have better techniques than we had back then. But it was really a series of mistakes made by the laboratory, by the doctor, by the investigative team, and maybe there was some, purpose to try to incriminate her. You know, we don't know. The point is that we need to be more vigilant. Okay, herbals. They're natural, but are they safe? This is a story called Jacked. It is about a 24-year-old soldier in Iran who buys a muscle supplement from the Marine Corps base shop. Okay, so the picture in the middle there is the MCX. It's the Marine Corps Exchange. So everybody thinks, oh, that should be safe. During a workout, he develops chest pain and dies right in front of his weightlifting machine. Autopsies conducted. His coronary arteries are totally clean. He's a 24-year-old, physically fit, young, virile man who's dead on the carpet there. What was in that supplement? Well, it doesn't really matter what it was. The point is that it was something that shouldn't have been there. It was something that was sold as being safe, as being a supplement, when in fact it was a poison. We got a hold of that material. There's an address down there. You can see Mumbai, India. So you do a little Google Earth map of that address, and it's the middle of the highway somewhere. So, you know, when it's buyer beware. You buy these herbal products. You don't know where they're coming from. Good luck. You're on your own. Here's another story called Duffer Dysfunction. It's about a senior professional golfer who orders an erectile dysfunction herbal over the internet, okay? So he's trying to regain his glory when he was younger and needs a little bit of help. And so after a PGA senior event, he hooks up with a female fan, and hoping to score big, he doubles his doses of this erectile dysfunction drug, all right? Well, as you can kind of get from my tenor, things don't go well. He has a heart attack. He's dead in bed. This story was written in 2013. Can this happen? I would have to say to you, not only can it happen, it has. This is Lamar Odom, star basketball player for the LA Lakers, married to one of the Kardashians, fighting for his life this time last year because he took an herbal erectile dysfunction drug while he was with prostitutes in Las Vegas. Now, he survived. I thought that he wasn't going to make it. But this is a situation of life imitates art far more often than art imitates life. And this was a quote made by Oscar Wilde. And then there's this story, which I call the toadstool gourmand. A grandmother from Taiwan is visiting her son. While babysitting, she visits the field nearby and picks mushroom for their evening meal. Okay, now the son and daughter-in-law are off at some event, and then she's at home with the child and is cooking dinner. Okay, and so she picks these mushrooms. There's the scientific name, and she's used to using these mushrooms. She picks them. They grow wild in Taipei all the time. But then she becomes violently ill after eating this mushroom-laced meal. Calls her son to come home. They go to SFGH. We get involved. We look at the mushroom pieces to try to determine what it is that the mother had used in the dinner. And what did we find? Well, we found Amanita phalloides, which is a highly poisonous mushroom. But I venture to say that if you look at those two mushrooms, you probably can't pick the difference between them. One is safe, one is deadly. So a liver specialist is called. He's experimenting with this new procedure called milk thistle. It's not FDA approved yet. So he has to get special permission from the FDA for an emergency shipment of this thistle from an investigator in Germany. It arrives that evening on Lufthansa. Goes to the airport, picks up the package, and he realizes that there's only enough for one person. It was both the grandmother and the son that had been violently ill. And the next shipment wasn't going to come once they found out that they didn't have enough for another 24 hours. The family had to decide. Was he going to give it to the son, or was he going to give it to the grandmother? The son is Asian. The wife is Caucasian. The son is mixed. This is a dilemma that that I hope that none of you will ever have to face. I won't tell you what happened. You have to buy my book. So those are what you don't know can kill you, but my book also talks about you may need what my lab provides, okay? So you probably remember this. This is 2.5 years ago, SFO, Asiana airplane crash. I'm on the golf course. I get this call. We have a crash. Expect a lot of injuries. And so this is a picture, top view of the plane crash. And I ask you the question, what's wrong with this picture? Other than the fact that there's no tail, we know what happened. The tail hit the ground, and there were some students who got ejected from the plane. They got run over by some of the flame retardant folks, the EMS. That's not what I want you to focus on. I want you to focus on this. So the FAA says you're in a burning plane. Evacuation chutes have been deployed. You need to completely evacuate the entire plane in 90 seconds if we can ensure your safety. That's the goal. 250 passengers in 90 seconds. How many people are going to get out of that particular side of the plane, climbing down a ladder? Okay, well, okay, so the ladder wasn't there. The point of this slide, what was wrong with this picture, is that that side of the plane did not deploy correctly. The airbag deployed inside the plane and not outside the plane. And nobody could get out that side. Everybody else had to go out the wing or the port side and or the tail. All right? So, but unfortunately, when the air chute deployed, it knocked over a couple of the flight attendants, unconscious. They're in the middle of the hallway, the corridor of a burning plane. And it's tragic if it wasn't funny. You could see their feet hanging out from underneath this airbag. Okay, so this is not a small airbag. It's an airbag that's longer than the distance from here to the wall. and it's filled with chemicals. The pilot, once he sees that everybody's has gotten out, climbs out himself and sees these two women unconscious in this burning plane. Okay, again, this is a heroic story that no one knows about. Goes back into the cockpit, grabs an axe. Okay, we have axes in the cockpits now because, you know, the security doors after 9/11, you can't break in. Well, what if you need to break out? Well, they have axes. Takes the axe, sharp part of the axe, punctures the bag, rescues the women. They come to my hospital. I get this call. We have these women. They're very sick, and we don't know why. We think that they've been poisoned. Poisoned? Poisoned by what? Well, what's inside an airbag? It's this chemical called sodium azide. It's very toxic. It's very explosive. In fact, that's how it works. In fact, you have this in your car today. It is how we inflate our airbag. You puncture the airbag. I mean, you have an accident. The airbag ignites, and the sodium azide gets converted to nitrogen gas, and it prevents you from hitting your head onto the steering wheel. And they thought that maybe in the process of puncturing that bag that these airline stewardesses got injured and got exposed. They recovered from their injury, but then they were exposed to these chemicals. And we had to try to figure out that puzzle. I think I'm going to bypass this the story and just show you the video. This is Pop 2010 held at the Cow Palace. It's basically a rave party, but this particular one in 2010 turned very deadly.
Now to that huge rave at the Cow Palace that sent 11 people to the hospital. Tonight, five of them are still in critical condition, including one who's in a coma. We're also learning more tonight about the young man who died, reportedly from taking tainted drugs. KTVU's Amber Lee, live tonight at one hospital that is treating some of those patients. Amber?
Frank, we're at SF General, where 23-year-old Anthony Mata died and two others remain hospitalized here following Saturday night's rave. Tonight, Anthony's family told us they...
Okay, so the newscast says... I'm sorry? Oh, sorry. So the newscast said that these kids were taking tainted drugs. And so we got these samples, and the cops were desperate for us to try to figure out what it was in these samples that these kids were taking, because they wanted to prosecute the guy who was pushing it. And at the same time, I had other kids who were in this hospital who were surviving and had the same problems. And so my motivation was, I don't care what the law enforcement says, we have lives to save. So we did an analysis over that weekend. This is always held over the Memorial Day weekend. And my staff spent the entire weekend working on this case. And we ended up finding out that it was not, in fact, a tainted capsule. In fact, it was an unintentional overdose. That the capsules that were given to these people were at double and triple the dosage. And there were some reason that these particular kids, and they were all Asian, had some type of genetic predisposition towards having the side effect. Okay, I'm just going to tell you about one or two cases about my microbiology book. It's called Microbiology, Because What You Don't Know Will Kill You. You know, we live in a world where we live in their world. We live in the microbiology world. There are more microorganisms in our bodies than human cells, and it's everywhere. But it's not one for you to be afraid. It's one for you to be to recognize. So here's a story about a woman who's obsessed with cleanliness. It's called misophobia. It's a term that describes Howie Mandel, who is always cleaning his hands. He's always got sanitizers. She scrapes a knee while playing soccer. It gets infected with a methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which was present from the previous soccer player. We have this as a problem amongst many of our professional athletes, and she ends up getting a debilitating illness. And then here is a story called Twin Infection. It's about these two boys. They're going to college, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. They come home during the Thanksgiving weekend, go to a party like often, one of their cousins is sick and she's coughing all over these guys. And they end up getting sick when they go back to their colleges on that following weekend. The college on one side does a traditional blood culture, which takes sometimes 5 to 7 days to get a result. The infirmary at the other college does a modern molecular test that gives you results within hours. There was a delay in the diagnosis in the boy on the left, and he dies. There was an immediate diagnosis made in the boy on the right. He's given the antibiotics that's necessary, and he lives. So this is where, if you had some background and knew about what it is that's being done, advanced knowledge of technology, it could save your life. Okay, and in my last book, something a little bit different is called Performance Enhancing Drugs, The Hidden Assassin, Part 2. And the theme here is that bad things happen to people who use PEDs, but more importantly, they happen to also to their family members. All right? So to introduce this, I'm going to show you yet another video, but this one doesn't have any audio. All right? It's about a football game that was held last fall up in the North Marin County area. And I want you to focus on the back judge referee. What happens to the referee, not the actual play, but the referee, all right? And it'll be shown twice. Okay, so you see the referee standing there. He's on the 10-yard line, okay? But there's two safeties. I'm sorry. There's two guys that are on the defense there that are behind him. Okay. No, this was targeted. This was steroid rage. This is what happens when you hype yourself up to the point where you lose control, you end up having really no sense. And this particular, so the coach was fired and the kids were suspended. I mean, they're not playing football anymore. And it's all because they took some of these PEDs. So I have a series of stories that involves these cases. And it centers around this rogue chemist who used to work for me. He is a tech in our workplace drug testing lab. He uncovers one of his clients who has urine tested every 3 months, and he's a school bus driver, and he's cheating because he's adulterating his urine to hide his drug addiction. Finally, he has the data needed to convict him to actually show that he is using to his employer. But on that day, he's driving his bus, he's using heroin, and he causes a traffic accident. It's all over the news. He's in the lab. He gets a phone call from the police while he's at work, and it's because of his family. His family was on that school bus. So what happens? This guy's name is Calvin. He turns Calvin's family's wife and child die. That's correct. Okay, so I have to disclose, that part was fake. But the science behind the drug testing and the need to catch these people is very real. And so he ends up leaving my lab, forms a company, and becomes one of the bad guys, sort of like this TV show Breaking Bad. And so he starts manufacturing anabolic steroids, like the one that football player. Maybe you remember this story last year, Ray Rice dragging his fiancée in the elevator by her hair after he knocks her out. Okay, this is not normal behavior. He's on steroids. Doping agents, we know who that is. Self-disclosed finally. Most of you don't know that Anna Nicole Smith abused growth hormone. Didn't cause her death, but it was a factor in it. You know, so the question is, why growth hormone? You know, everybody wants to look young. Growth hormone improves your appearance, improves your stamina. It's abused by athletes, but it's also abused by Hollywood. It's the miracle fountain of youth. Of course, none of that's true. beta blockers. Okay, so this is the biathlon. It's a shooting and cross-country skiing event where if you can control your heart rate, you can do better at shooting after you've just cross-country 50 kilometers. And athletes abuse beta blockers because they can regulate their heart rate and shoot their rifle at the target in between heartbeats. That's how good they are. So it's actually banned against the International Olympic Committee. Puberty-delaying drugs, okay? I'm not accusing this woman. She's obviously Asian. But you can take hormones that prevent or delay your natural development into womanhood. And if you're a gymnast or if you're a skater or if you're something that where a thin body shape is to your advantage, you can abuse this. Okay. She may be 17, but she doesn't look 17. This is a baseball player who's since retired. He was using HCG. HCG is this pregnancy hormone. Well, why was he using that? Okay, you got to find out about that from my book. And this is Demi Moore. Demi Moore abused and self-disclosed. I wasn't part of that. That she was taking nitrous oxide. Okay, so nitrous oxide improves your sexual capabilities. It enhances sexual activity. So, is the public interested in clinical lab science? Are you interested in clinical lab science? I hope that you are. My hypothesis is that, yes, you are and you should be. And here is the evidence. These TV shows are about science, but it's in conjunction with crime. My hypothesis is that if there were a TV show about clinical laboratory testing, but written in a science perspective, that this would also do very well because people are interested in health. You know, crime is something that happens to somebody else. We hope it doesn't happen to us, but everybody's affected by disease. You know somebody with heart disease or died of breast cancer or whatever. And if you could help them by learning a little bit about laboratory science through a TV show, I think that you would watch it. So this is what I'm working on now. Not crime science investigation, but clinical laboratory investigation. Every week, a different story. So I want to thank you for coming tonight. I hope that that this was amusing to you and also informational.
Thank you. So now it's open for audience questions.
Yeah, going back to the DNA testing, do labs offer that or is the cost so much that your HMO is going to say, no, just like an MRI, after you take it, you have 15 phone calls, even though it was doctor prescribed?
Yeah, so that is part of our problem, is that these tests are quite a bit more expensive, and they haven't all caught on to mainstream. And so a lot of them are not paid for or reimbursed by the medical, by the insurance companies. My hypothesis is that, you know, if it comes to your health and if it comes to something that you think will really make a difference, you would pay out of pocket. You're talking about $50 to $75. Would you even think twice over that? Maybe we can look at that afterwards. Did you have a question?
Oh, hi. Self-disclosure, I'm a medical librarian, actually, and I thought your talk was very interesting.
Thank you.
One thing, though, in terms of the herbal supplements, I might flip it in a different direction. And just mention that, and I know you're aware of the fact that very few patients disclose to their doctors that they are on herbal supplements. And there are so many interactions, you know, whether it's fruits and vegetables or other medications. So I just thought I'd mention that because that's sort of the flip side of, you know, of the issue.
Yeah, so I think the moral of that story is that if you're on any of these herbal medications, that you disclose that to your physician, not just what it is, but I even ask patients to bring in their herbal medications because sometimes when we see adverse events, we'll do testing of the supplements themselves to make sure that they are what they say they are. We have advanced technologies that allow us to do that. It's just all going to be positive. Yeah.
One of the for full disclosure, I was in a clinical trial. I had stage 4B cancer. And one of the odd things, so I've had a lot of tests of all sorts, and one of the weird things about blood tests that I've learned is that there's the normal range of tests, whether it's liver function, whatever, there's a normal range. But there are people that are always outside those ranges, and there's not a lot of consideration given to that even when you know your medical practitioners really well. And if you could just talk a little bit about, and it might not show up on your test. You might be in the normal ranges, but it might be out of range for you. So if you could discuss that a little bit, it would be great.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty complicated question. We set our normal ranges so that it covers 95% of the population, which means 2.5% of the time you're going to get a low result and there's nothing wrong with you, and 2.5% of the time the opposite. Your situation is that what if you have a value that's within the normal range for the population but is not normal for you? None of these things are well appreciated by my medical practitioners. And it's a clinical lab issue that we struggle with. How do we communicate? How do we make sure that the information is treated correctly? And it's a losing battle, I have to say.
So I guess to add on to that, as there's been more push toward the public having access to their own clinical information and medical records, how do we... I mean, I work in the life science industry, so how do we explain the complexities of sensitivities versus specificities, or being able to talk about where someone fits specifically in the ranges and avoid the issue of making important medical decisions based upon that data as we start to share that more with the public, and those decisions are made that maybe that not the correct decision and the person wasn't able to read the data properly. So how do we balance that?
Yeah, so no easy answer to that question. Obviously, you don't want to play doctor and start superseding the decisions made by your physician. My point really is to just understand what's being done and what are the pluses and minuses so that there can be a little bit more of an intelligent discussion with your caregiver. That's still going to be your best bet, but there's no reason that we can't challenge them and not just say for gospel, okay, jump how high?
And I guess follow up, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So, and then when it comes to pharmacogenomics and molecular diagnostics, even though some of these companies are able to express to insurance companies the value of what that provides and potential of extension, how much life extension that could be when you talk about cancer and the quality adjusted life years that are associated with those kind of tests, but yet insurance companies are not willing to reimburse them. From your experience, what do you feel is the reasoning behind why these insurance companies might not reimburse some of these tests?
Well, some of them are not proven. So the company down in the peninsula called 23andMe, you're probably familiar with, you can get a cheek swab and get your full DNA sequence done, and then they'll tell you if you're going to develop cancer or diabetes or Alzheimer's disease. A lot of those things are unproven. That's why they're not reimbursed. I actually am not a proponent of 23andMe. I don't think that that's something we're ready to do because the information that we have is not always actionable and it's not evidence-based. But having said that, there is a part of that that is legitimate, and that's the pharmacogenomic piece. So when the FDA went back and shut them down and said, you know, you need physician orders and you need controls, they went back and started pushing other agendas, not the disease risk part, but the pharmacogenomic part and the ancestry part, which is really more FYI. Am I related to so-and-so? Where did my gene pool originate? But the pharmacogenomic piece is different from the risk disease portion. Here we're trying to determine if a drug, even somebody in health, is going to be effective to you or not. Whether you need that drug is irrelevant. So I look at it as something like saying, well, you know, you have a peanut allergy, and all that means is you just need to stay away from peanuts. It doesn't mean that I'm going to die because I have this disease or I'm going to have Huntington's disease, for which there's no cure. It's just a more information precaution to make your life live a little bit easier and longer. Exactly. Drug metabolism. Yep.
How do I know the herbal supplements that I buy are actually what I think they are? Like I take curcumin. If I go to Whole Foods and buy it, can I then take it to a lab and pay some lab to tell me what's actually in there?
Well, my lab actually does that, but I'm not here to promote that. My best advice is to look at the package insert, look at where the company is listed, go to the internet, see if it's a legitimate location, a legitimate company. I mean, don't get me wrong, most of the stuff that's out there is legitimate. And most of the stuff that you're going to get from Whole Foods is legitimate. It's just occasionally there's going to be stuff that sneaks in mislabeled or somebody didn't do their due diligence and you get problems. But it's a very small minority.
So I have a question. Do you recommend people get certain tests, say, on an annual basis when they get older? What would you recommend in terms of testing to know what your status is, whether you have a risk of this and that disease?
Yeah, so the whole question of health screening has been debated for many years, and I'm actually not a proponent of that. The problem is because if you don't have anything specifically wrong, you're going to find out about a lot of things that are unrelated. So, I mean, they used to offer total CT scanning, every slice of your body, and what happened was they found all kinds of tumors, but these tumors didn't have any clinical relevance, and that they were natural. They were just part of regular growth. They weren't cancer. Unless you have clinical symptoms that suggest that there might be something wrong, so if you're a smoker, you start coughing up blood, that's the time to do screening before it becomes stage 4 lung cancer.
All right, any more questions? If not, our thanks to Professor Alan Wu for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.